Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He's also the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of the New Authoritarianism, and The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And his latest book just out is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And he has an article at Truthdig, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
It's good to be on again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Henry. And yesterday I spoke with the historian Benjamin Hett, who has a new book, The Death of Democracy, which tells the history of the rise of the Nazis in the 1920s and 1930s, and without mentioning Trump by name, has uncanny, in fact, terrifying analogies with the current political situation and this leader who just yesterday made it clear that he has, you know, we've talked politely about him having authoritarian tendencies. They were absolutely manifest. They were sort of arcing off him like a transformer blowing up. It's so clear that America is in danger because it has a leader who is dangerous. And he has enormous power. He's going to add to the pollution from cars simply because he has the power to do so out of spite. I mean, this is a frightening moment we're in. And I just don't see people being aware of the dangers. There's a peculiar kind of complacency. How do you see the current situation?
Well, I mean, I think that in part you're right. I think in many ways this kind of authoritarianism has been with us for so long that it's become normalized. What he's done is just simply ratchet it up and make it so visible that it appears extraordinary and seems less to be symptomatic than something deeper than it does to be rather, something unique to this presidency. But I think one of the problems that I see around the really absolutely terrifying increasing sort of resemblances to what we might call the horrifying echoes of the past is the way the media refuses to name this. I mean, I'm just so sick of the New York Times and David Leonhardt and others saying things like, well, this isn't really fascism. This isn't really a sort of dictatorship of the sort that we saw in Germany and Italy in the 1930s, or Pinochet in the 1970s. Well, actually, that's a very dumb sort of understanding of fascism, because it seems to suggest that fascism is something static historically that basically you can only sort of analyze as an historical relic, as opposed to looking at the way fascism becomes a heuristic tool to be able to understand how the basic elements of fascism really sort of redeploy themselves in different forms. And I think that in light of what you've just said, never mind, you know, the ongoing use of his power to pollute the planet. I mean, this is a guy who is actually whipping up a mass hysteria in a kind of ultra-nationalism, but most importantly, the rhetoric of authoritarianism and the rhetoric of white supremacy and the rhetoric of violence that I find enormously frightening. I mean, think about what just happened with CNN yesterday. The crowds at his rally were taunting the CNN reporter, yelling fake news, swearing at him, giving him the finger. And, you know, Jim Coster, I believe is his name, and he said he got off. And he posted the line that this is terrifying, you know, that the possibility for violence here against journalists. And, of course, then Trump's son, Eric, puts a tweet out supporting it, which Trump then forwarded. I mean, so I don't know how much closer we come to the basic tenets of fascism before we realize that this is not just a dangerous, eccentric moment in history, that this country is basically now on the verge of instituting a kind of fascism that, if it gets more extreme, there'll be no question whatsoever about the historical moment in which we find ourselves.
But when you mention a reporter sort of being kind of mealy-mouthed about the reality of the dangers that Trump poses, it's almost like, what is it going to take? On the program today, we discussed the attacks on Jim Acosta of CNN and also this new far-right-wing phenomenon, QAnon.
Right.
And they were all over that rally, these peculiar people with these bizarre ideas. And, you know, it's just a matter of time before somebody in the press is either beaten up badly or even worse.
The side of this, of course, is that, you know, we saw this throughout the presidential campaign. I mean, his willingness, for instance, to pay the legal costs for one guy who basically had attacked an anti-Trump African-American critic as he was walking up the stairs. He has repeatedly sort of been on the verge of just outrightly legitimating violence against a whole range of groups, never mind just squelching dissent. I mean, think about what he said to those police chiefs in New Jersey when he said, hey, look, when you put you arrest these guys and you're pushing down on their heads, he said, you know, bang their heads against the car. The police chief of in that town had to apologize to the press. He said, oh, wait a minute. No, this is not quite what we want. I mean, Trump has a notion of law and order that basically is not unlike what we would associate with stormtroopers. I mean, this is a guy who really believes that lawlessness is the order of the day and that violence and absolute power are the ultimate essence of politics. He has emptied politics out, basically, of its democratic elements. He hates the press. He hates dissent. He hates any kind of accountability. He believes that he's above the law. He tries to disable other institutions in the government that would hold him accountable. I mean, I don't know basically where it ends. He's anti-intellectual. He has a contempt for weakness. He's a hyper-masculine guy who has a fear of the other. And the ultra-nationalism. But what is even more striking is, here's a guy who is doing everything he can to insult every leader in the Western Alliance, while at the same time he praises these murderous thugs who lead countries like North Korea, the Philippines, Turkey, Hungary. Where does it end? I mean, the guy is completely unapologetic about his authoritarian tendencies. And what's worse is that he now has the power of a Congress that basically is right out of the Vichy regime. I mean, these are real cowards. I mean, these are people who basically have no consideration for democracy, have no consideration for justice, and they follow him like lemmings. So it's a very dangerous moment. I mean, I guess that's what we're saying. I mean, of course, there are people who are recognizing this. I mean, there are groups that are mobilizing, and there are groups that basically are doing everything they can to see if they can somewhat modify this by winning the elections in 2018. But at the same time, I think the nature of this danger, and I think this is where we're going with this, it has to be named. We really have to talk about this as fascism. I mean, I use the expression neoliberal fascism because I really believe that neoliberalism has created the conditions that have made much of this possible. The economic misery, the hate, the racism, you name it. But it seems to me that until we come to grips with the fact that we now are in a form of extreme capitalism that has created such polarization and has intensified all the basic problems that this country has, that it creates the conditions that are ripe for the strong man, you know, for the authoritarian, for the fascist, who wants to really basically mobilize as much as he can, as much fear, insecurity, and uncertainty that he can.
And, of course, I can't remember who it was that said when fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and holding the Bible.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of quotes, and that's one of them. But I think the other quote that was made by Adorno, which I actually love, he says, I consider the survival of national socialism within democracy to be potentially more menacing than the survival of fascist tendencies against democracy. That's the smartest quote I've heard in a long time. And I think that's one that people in the United States have really got to start to take very, very seriously, because they're basically losing their freedoms. You know, they're losing the ability to be able to understand that, A, capitalism and democracy are not the same thing, and, B, that all of a sudden what they've given up by virtue of the long-standing loss of democratic institutions since the 1970s is they've given up the ability to even name the country they live in as a democratic society. This is not a democracy anymore. Let's be realistic. I mean, the Princeton study that came out a few years ago, looking at the policies that had gone on for the last 30 years, was very clear in saying that almost 95% of those policies had nothing to do with serving the interests of the public good, and that they called it an oligarchy. They said, this is an oligarchy. You know, it's a country run by the rich. It's a country run by big corporations. I mean, the average CEO salary in the United States is $13 million a year, $12 million a year. You know, this is something that needs to be understood in all of its facets. You can't have a democracy and have something like 5% of the population, I'm sorry, 1% of the population controlling, you know, half the wealth in the country. It doesn't work. The level of inequality that neoliberalism has produced, this casino capitalism, has generated the conditions for such precarity, such uncertainty, such fear. You know, fear of not having a job, fear of the other, fear of Muslims, you know, fear of the future, that it's created a society now that's so militaristic, so overly concerned with questions of violence as the only way to solve social problems, that law and order now becomes the quid pro quo of what it means to have any kind of exchange, that commercial relationships are the only relationships that matter, that it's not surprising that Trump resonates with a certain element of the population. Couple that with a culture that is so engrossed in civic illiteracy, so dumb in terms of its inability to take critique and self-reflection and critical education seriously, it seems like the perfect storm.
And, of course, Trump talked about the storm, and that has led to the formation of this underground lunatic far-right group called QAnon, who are waiting for the storm. And, again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. His latest book just out is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, and he has an article at Truthdig, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History. And I mentioned earlier, Henry, that it, not only are so much of our public and press blind to the reality of this incipient Trumpian fascism, he is in our face. It's not like he's hiding it.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, the way that he's, for example, just decided to start having cars pollute and try to weaken California's ability to move into the 21st century and deal with climate change. And by the way, the people in California do want, and other states that have signed on to the CAFE standards, they do want clean air and they don't want polluting vehicles. So he's just done this out of spite.
I think that one of the things that is always typical of authoritarian psychopaths is that in many cases, many people believe that there's an ideology at work that's very systemic that one can point to try to understand what people like them do. You know, whether it's, you know, Duterte in the Philippines, who says that he thinks now that killing journalists is just as important as killing drug dealers. But I think that like many of these dictators, this guy feeds off a kind of contempt for anyone that he sees being in opposition to him. Remember, Ian, the statement he made, which is almost basically insane. He said that those Democrats that didn't stand after his last State of the Union address probably were committing treason. He told that to one of his groups. And, you know, can you imagine committing treason? Treason is a crime punishing that can be punished by death. I mean, this guy has such a hatred of anyone who holds him accountable, that my sense is that there's a side of him that doesn't even understand the pollution issue, that really doesn't believe that the damage that could be done, doesn't have the figures, hasn't done the analysis, has not looked at the literature. He's looking at California like he looks at the East Coast, and he's saying, hey, they're not on my side, let's punish them, right? I mean, let's do something awful to them. And I think in many ways, this is a politics, not just a diversion, as many people in the press argue. This is a politics of utter destruction of the enemy. The enemy being the press, the enemy of the American people. This is a Stalin's term, a term that was used to basically kill people and make them disappear. And I think that this is a term that Trump feels very comfortable with, as we know, as a result of his conversation recently with Sulzberger, the head of the New York Times. He's very comfortable with these notions. And I think, in that sense, he's really very, very dangerous and getting increasingly more dangerous as he becomes more unsettled by the Mueller investigation, the possibility of what Cohen might say, and other kind of leaks that are now taking place in his administration.
Well, in terms of being in your face, Mnuchin, his Secretary of the Treasury, who's a total disgraceful toady.
Despicable man.
He is a despicable man, and even his own father won't talk to him. He just announced that they were going to find a way and jiggle the books at Treasury to give the super rich, the ultra rich, an extra $100 billion in tax cuts. This is after the tax cuts, the $1.5 trillion, that almost all went to the big corporations and the most richest people in this country. It's blown out the deficit. Revenues aren't coming in, as Trump promised, because the corporations are doing write-downs and not repatriating the money that Trump promised. The whole thing is a massive scam. But again, in your face, the idea that in the face of this vast transfer of wealth away from the poor and middle classes to the wealthy in this country, that they're going to add even more with a $100 billion gift to the super rich, you know, the arrogance of these people, I guess, is in direct consequence of our general apathy. I mean,
no, I agree with you. I think that's very perceptive. I mean, I think that one of the things that you've said repeatedly in this exchange that we're having, and I said in my work, and certainly in the new book, one of the defining characteristics of this kind of neoliberal fascism, you know, a fascism for the rich that really sort of benefits the rich in multiple ways, is the absolute lack of any kind of self-reflection about its consequences. You know, one of the basic tenets of neoliberalism is that you can divorce economic activity from social cost, as you well know. You don't have to worry about social cost. It doesn't matter what the consequences are. But we've never seen it ratcheted up to the degree, like everything else in this administration, that we see now on display. Not only is there no apology, not only is there no attempt to hide this, there seems to be a certain glee, a certain cathartic kind of appropriation output in just making people suffer while having the 1% benefit. I mean, that's what I find disturbing. Suffering seems to be something that these people, mass suffering, seems to be something that these people enjoy when they produce it. It's not as if they're doing this and then going underground, right? I mean, going dark, you know, putting policies together on a weekend and then disappearing. They actually get on talk shows and say things that in any fascist country you'd expect to hear, like Giuliani saying things like, collusion is not a crime. Jesus, I mean, you're going to be kidding me. You know, is this guy insane? And we're constantly hearing this kind of language, a language that is so outside the pale or the parameters of any kind of democratic discourse that, you know, the biggest fear we have is that it becomes normalized. You know, people will say, well, no, there is no president ever who has lied the way Trump does. There is no president ever who has basically promoted and legitimated violence against his critics. There is no president who has done so much to harm the environment as this guy is doing. I mean, these are all absolutes, and they're absolutes that speak to a concentration of power that appears to be unaccountable and will do more and more to make itself unaccountable by doing more and more to dismantle whatever checks and balances are in place in a democracy to somehow prevent that from happening.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Henry Giroux.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He's also the Paolo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of New Authoritarianism, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and his latest book just out is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And he has an article at Truthout, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.